Hello, I'm Caleb Howard, and this is Tales from Sacred Texts. The world is built on stories. From the beginning of time, humans have immersed themselves in legends and myth. When God himself wanted to explain to us what he was like, he didn't push elaborate treatises, but instead told stories about humanity. In this podcast, I tackle the concept of religion through stories and legends. Told through a 21st century lens, I explain to religious and non-religious people alike the stories that lie at the very heart of the belief that maybe there is a God, and maybe he really is good. When I was still brainstorming for this podcast in the spring and summer of 2019, one of my first ideas for an episode was the legends of powerful holy relics. The desire to tell a relic story kind of found itself into my first episode on Tobit with the story of the mysteriously powerful fish heart, but I never got into a true relic story. Until now. I meant to make this a general episode about the power of all relics, but instead I've decided to focus on only one of the most famous and powerful, the Spear of Destiny. The Spear of Destiny, also known as the Holy Lance, is the subject of a lot of folklore. The legends of its power vary greatly, almost as much as they vary from the biblical narrative of God. The Bible emphasizes that God's power is not up for grabs, and any powerful artifacts the Bible mentioned are powerful in their own right and only answer to God, not those who wield them. When two evil rapist priests bring the Ark of God into battle, it does not answer to them, and they fall in battle. The Philistines capture the Ark of God, but it does not answer to them either, and it brings calamity on their people. The Ark of God's power is God's, and God's alone. The spear legends are different. In some, the spear's power is up for grabs by whoever possesses it. The stories become stranger and more twisted as the legend grows, and as a result, God is portrayed as capricious and vindictive. In others, God only has incredible power where the spear is at. These stories are akin to the enemies of God testifying in 1 Kings that Yahweh was only God of certain regions. I want to emphasize right now that the theories of God in this episode are not my own, but only those related in the legend of the spear. They may not capture adequately the Christian view of God, but they are central to the dogmas that emerged and twisted the Christian faith into something different and almost unrecognizable. One more thing. The legends are splintered and fragmented, but I have collected them and woven them, along with my own ideas, into a coherent story. I hope you won't mind. It'll be a good story. But as I learned in 5th grade English, show, don't tell. So we'll get into the story and explore the legends of the spear as they developed. Longinus heard the groaning and cursing of the convicted criminals. He heard the shouts of the mob, the laughs of the psychopaths who came out to watch these executions for some reason, and the muttering of the Pharisees about how if this guy really was a god, he would have saved himself. He even heard the one weird prisoner who kept on begging his father to forgive the people who were executing him. That was a new one. Longinus heard a lot of things, but what he didn't do was see. Longinus was blind, or nearly so. Sometimes he could see dim outlines, but that was about it. So they made him crucify criminals? Ancient times was rough. There was no sort of welfare system for old soldiers who had lost their eyesight in the wars. They just had to sit around and torture people to death. Anyway, how can you crucify someone effectively when you don't know where to swing the hammer? Actually, the author of the story probably didn't know this, but blindness was literally the best disability to have in ancient Rome. People who were disabled in certain ways were rather out of luck. But blind people? They could even represent themselves in court. Very progressive. A society that focused on the eloquence of speech more than sight believed that the blind could still contribute to society in a meaningful way. And while this isn't very progressive by our standards, in ancient times this was huge. Soldiers who became blind were even given a stipend by the state. Longinus knew all this, of course, but he didn't want to live off the gracious whims of some emperor. Longinus wanted to serve his country, and yeah, he hated the job of torturing random people to death, but he had worked for years to become a centurion. he would hold on to meaning as long as he could. He didn't want to throw everything away quite yet and live out his final days in darkness, his only stimulation coming from 3 meals a day on the state's good graces. When Longinus thought about it, he wasn't actually sure why he was still allowed to be a centurion, but he supposed it was pity, which rankled him. It had been massive incompetence to let a nearly blind man lead a group of men, even if the leader merely supervised executions. In the midst of his musings, one of Longinus' subordinates came up to him. They had orders to speed up the deaths of the convicts. This was the Jews' holy Passover, not that the Romans cared, but there were Jewish radicals that did. These radicals were known for rioting, revolting, or picking off Roman soldiers when public sentiment got too strong against the occupying army. So the governor was trying to pacify everyone and get all the crucified criminals down off the crosses before riots broke out. So they were going to put the criminals out of their misery. Longinus stood up and grabbed the spear. He would do it. The soldier grabbed his arms. Longinus was blind. Someone else could take care of it. No. Longinus was firm. He was barely good for anything now. All it took was swinging a spear at the criminal's legs, and who really cared if he messed up the first few times, right? He'd do it. The soldier nodded, and Longinus went to break the legs of Jesus and the two thieves. He did the thieves first, but when he got to Jesus, his dim eyes failed him. Instead of swinging the spear at Jesus' legs, he accidentally plunged it into his side. The sky grew black. Even Longinus could perceive that. Thunder crashed and lightning flashed all around them, and the ground shook. The voice of God roared from heaven, and Longinus vainly clutched the spear in terror. The lightning found the spear and passed through it, and the weapon glowed an unnatural blue and orange. In the confusion, Longinus did not realize that some of Jesus' blood had gotten into his eyes. The sky gave one last angry flash, and then all was back to normal again. The spear was just a spear, the soldiers were still stumbling in terror, and Longinus saw the gory bodies of the condemned men. He saw. Longinus fell down, dropping the spear, and that's when he uttered the well-known line. Surely this was the Son of God. Tears flowed from his now-seeing eyes as he realized the very man whom he'd stabbed had, even in death, granted him a marvelous blessing. Unfortunately for Longinus, he didn't read enough Harry Potter to know that when the blood of a magical creature touches a weapon, it infuses that weapon with its power. Or perhaps, believing that the Son of God was not a magical creature, because literally who would believe that, reading Harry Potter wouldn't have helped him. Regardless, he left the spear lying where he had dropped it and ran into town, praising Jesus Christ. As he ran into town, yelling his praises for the blood of the man that had restored his sight, he stumbled on a Jewish man who cursed when he heard Longinus' words. But the cursing was not angry. Rather, the man's words were those of despair. What was wrong? The man groaned. He had screwed up. Big time. Longinus questioned the man further. What had he done wrong? Well, he was a cobbler by trade, and he really hated Jesus. The guy was a scam artist who kept deceiving all his friends. Saying weird things like people would drink his blood and all that garbage. I mean, really? Did the guy sound sane? Plus, he worshipped the Pharisees. Those guys were, like, A-grade material. Longinus rolled his eyes. The Pharisees? Seriously? The biggest hypocrites he had ever met. The cobbler began to get angry, but he realized he had screwed up, so maybe he shouldn't be angry. He continued to tell his story. Pilate had pronounced the sentence of death, and he had been excited. He had been in the crowd screaming, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" And he was trying to outdo all his fellows and being simply terrible to a dying man because he was a massive jerk. So when Jesus stumbled carrying the cross, he yelled at him to hurry up. And Jesus had looked right at the man, saying coolly that he was on his way to his death and he would make it there eventually, but that the Jewish man would never die. Longinus was confused. All he'd heard Jesus saying was, "Forgive them, Father," to everyone who was insulting him. He didn't sound like the type of guy who would curse someone for taunting him when the whole crowd had been doing it. Oh, but he had. The Jewish man wailed. And he had thought it was funny. He had laughed at Jesus. Then, but now, the thunder, the lightning, the blood healing Longinus's eyes. Jesus had legitimate power. His words had most definitely been a binding curse. The Jewish man now knew that he would never die. Longinus, who had ordered his soldiers to nail Jesus to the cross and who had stabbed him in the side, felt lucky that the Son of God had not directed his capers at him, but rather some random Jewish guy who had said a mean thing. I mean, the same guy who had cursed a Jewish guy saying mean things had given him, the man who had presided over his torture and execution, his eyesight back. Seemed a little fishy to him, but he wasn't complaining. "Tough luck," Longinus said, and he had really meant it, but he was going to tell more people about Jesus now. "Hopefully, maybe," he advised, "that if the Jewish man repented before God and offered sacrifices or something, whatever the Jewish people did, he didn't really know, maybe then the man's prophesied fate would not come to pass." Maybe. And for the first time, he saw something that looked like hope in the man's eyes. The Jewish man turned, and this time he truly wished Longinus the best of luck. Longinus walked off, shouting the praises of Jesus to anyone who would listen, and disappeared into the crowds of the already darkening city as the religious leaders were running to the home of Pilate, now realizing they were truly in over their heads. As time passed, superstition regarding the incident grew. There were only the faintest of whispers at first, but then a Roman provost decided to mutilate a Christian guy whose name literally meant aphrodisiac. I mean, if you're super evil, like comic book level evil, then you would need to at least try, right? See what happens. The provost immediately lost his sight as a direct punishment from God, and Longinus begged the provost to cut off his head to earn his sight back. "Wait, what? You want me to decapitate you? Am I reading this right at all?" the provost asked. Like, this just does not track at all. Longinus nodded. That was exactly what he was saying. Despite that being a very bizarre and fictional sounding fact pattern, the provost alleged the story was true and became a servant of Jesus when, at the very moment Longinus's head was severed, his sight came back better than before. You'd think that God wouldn't reward you for killing one Christian when he punished you for killing another, but legends are super weird. The whispers became louder as people started believing that there was some sort of Elder Wand situation where the power of the blood passed on from the holder who was murdered to the murderer. Some people tried to murder the provost and see if they could gain the power for themselves, but no one was ever successful, and the provost passed to his rest, taking the power with him. Or so everyone thought. Hundreds of years later, the rumors began to reemerge. Somebody had found the stained, bloody spear, maybe in some Roman armory or on some battlefield or in some rubbish heap. But when they held the spear, mysterious things began to happen to them. Good mysterious. The magic of the spear began to run through their lives, to give them power, to make all their endeavors successful. In the one day they had lost the spear. Maybe the wife questioned having a bloody spear in their house and threw out their husband's weird D&D prop while he was away at work. Everything changed. It had been that day that the husband was run over by a chariot on the way to the market and died in agony. And just like that, the spear passed to another. Like all magical items, maybe the spear had a mind of its own. Maybe it wanted to be found. Or perhaps the more the legend grew, the more people sought it, and it began to pass from individual to individual, and blood was shed in the search for the spear's power. More people claimed to hold the Spear of Destiny, even if they didn't. Numerous fakes were circulated, some intentionally and some otherwise. One good thing would happen to them while they were holding a spear, and then they decided that that was the spear. Legends began to crop up all over the world, but they all had the same core. It was the spear that gave power. Longinus had held literal godhood in his hands for the briefest of seconds, but had dropped it in his ignorance. Though he hadn't ever truly wielded its magical power, perhaps the blood in his eyes had made him a spear of sorts, and thus his death had brought life to the provost. Yet Longinus had lost the unlimited power of the true relic in his ignorance. Europeans made up stories about how they had the lance because it was good business. Constantine was the first to supposedly have it, and his empire had flourished. Upon Constantine's death, the spear passed to the Pope. The Popes, corrupt men who craved power, sought in Charlemagne a vessel to extend their power to the political sphere and gifted him the spear. Charlemagne carried it through 47 battles to victory and founded the Holy Roman Empire. He held the blessed spear through those battles, and his soldiers won again and again against all odds. Somehow, every arrow they fired hit its mark. Every sword found the heart of its enemy, and every trebuchet breached the enemy's walls. But as his power grew, so did his carelessness. Charlemagne, in the heady intoxication of victory, let the spear fall loose from his grasp, and as he did, felt a sharp pain in his chest. It was a sudden onset of the illness that was to take his life, and so the spear passed on to its next unfortunate victim. Years later, Frederick I Barbarossa held the spear in his hand as he waded into the river. The spear had been by his side throughout his superhuman successes, and whispers passed around that he held the Holy Lance. But maybe the spear had a will of its own, and it betrayed Frederick to a fate worse than death. For as he waded into the water, he dropped the spear, and it was swept downriver, and the spear disappears from the annals of history. Legends say that Barbarossa never died, but he too was swept away into some stronghold of the Kyffhäuser Mountains. There, he lives in a perpetual state of twilight sleep, somewhat aware of what passes around him, but powerless to do anything but raise his hand. He occasionally sends one of his servants, entombed with him under the same terrible curse, to walk a few steps to a vantage point. There, the servant can see if the magic of the spear has broken, and if they can escape. But for the past 800 years, nothing has changed. Legend states that the spear will release Barbarossa to fight in glorious battle for one final showdown against the Antichrist. Modern tyrants have sought the spear for years upon years. Napoleon attempted to hunt for it in Germany at the height of his empire, but the Germans found it first and sent it to Vienna where it would be safe. Legend has it that a young art student in Vienna found the spear. As he touched it, power flowed through him and he began to plot and scheme. The spear became the source of Adolf Hitler's bewitchment of the people of Germany and his early successes in the war. But when he moved the spear back to Austria for safekeeping, his power began to wane and the Allies began to take back the territory they had lost. Still, Hitler remained formidable, as though he did not have physical possession of the spear, he still had control over it. But when General Patton found the lance in an underground vault, Hitler's power was broken. The curse of the spear drove him to madness and suicide that very day. General Patton was next in line to be cursed by the spear. Not realizing its importance, he did not hold on to it. The spear had its revenge, and within the year, Patton died a horrible death thanks to a car crash. While these legends are held by some to be sacred, others doubt them. Charlemagne didn't die because he dropped the spear. He dropped it because he was dying. Barbarossa dropped the spear because he was swept away by the water. Hitler was already doomed before he lost the spear. The only effect its loss may have had on his suicide was some slight psychological effects. And Patton was just the victim of a freak accident. Other legends of the spear's dark and formidable curse reach into an unexpected country, England. According to the Acts of Nicodemus, some fanfiction apocrypha, Joseph of Arimathea was imprisoned shortly after the death of Jesus. The story is bizarre, with Jesus giving the devil power over the devil. I know, I had a double take just saying that. And a bunch of dead people from the Old Testament making cameo appearances, including Habakkuk. Habakkuk rolled his eyes. Seriously? I always get stuck being a cameo in these weird stories. I will probably go into more depth with the legends of Joseph later on, but long and short of it, he makes it to England carrying all the relics of Jesus' death. A reasonable explanation that I'd accept was that he wanted to get them as far away as possible from people who knew and would abuse their power, and it might be a good one if he didn't go around telling people all about Jesus and the relics and have his son literally become the island of Great Britain's spiritual leader. There was no incognito effort from Joseph at all in the fanfiction apocrypha. But really, do you expect the fanfiction apocrypha to be logical? And we'll find out what happens to the spear once it reaches England, but that will be right after this. Joseph was buried in Cardiff, Wales. There's actually a tomb you can go visit. When he died, his sons held the spear. Good magic flowed throughout the kingdom. But eventually, through the passage of time, the kingdom was buried in darkness and superstition. The magic arts were still remembered, but the source of the magical power was forgotten. Those who used magic now did so only for their own personal gain, and for evil. The spear was discovered again, completely by accident, when Balin, not the Hobbit Balin, but one of King Arthur's many knights, is searching for a murderer. He did not know the murderer by name, only by sight. He'd seen the man kill one of his friends, and he wanted revenge. Balin brutally tracked the murderer down and cut off his head with one stroke while at dinner. It turned out that the murderer was the brother of a powerful king, King Pellam. In the dog-eat-dog questing world of the Arthurian legends, where people killed each other for any reason or no reason at all, and because cutting someone's brother's head off at dinner would probably make anybody hungry for revenge, King Pellam charged at Balin as he wiped the sword clean. Balin raised his sword to block Pelham's strike, but the sword shattered like it had just hit a white walker. Balin took off running for his life, looking from room to room for any possible weapon he could use to protect himself. As Balin entered one particular corridor, he heard Pelham's voice behind him screaming for him to stop. They could work things out, just please don't touch the spear at the end of the corridor. But Balin thought that Pelham's words were only a ruse, and a poor one at that. I mean, when someone is threatening your very life, do you let them disarm you? Balin seized the spear, spun around, and thrust it through King Pelham's genitals. There was a flash of blinding light, a crack, and the castle began to tumble down around the two. Days later, Merlin uttered a spell and the pieces of the castle began to lift. He had warned Balin not to go to that region for revenge, not to mess with the magic of that land, but it had all been a ploy. Merlin knew that his words just made Balin more determined. He was playing the long game. Balin's mistake would be the catalyst to begin the greatest of all quests, the search for the Holy Grail. And Merlin needed that to happen. Balin gasped as the broken castle was lifted from his body. Not from the air rapidly re-entering his lungs, though that might have been part of the reason, but because the flourishing green countryside that he had seen days before was gone. Instead, he saw a wasteland without a trace of anything green. There was nothing beautiful. The magic had not just destroyed the land, but seemingly the restraint of many kings. They marshaled their armies to war, fiercely competing over the resources that were left. Balin looked around in sorrow and horror of what he had done, but then he cast his eyes on King Pellam. The wound in his groin was painful and dripping blood. Merlin boomed.
It will never heal. This land will never heal.
Henceforth, this event shall be known as the Dolorous Blow. That was a brief distraction for both Balin and Pellam. That seemed like overkill. What kind of name was the Dolorous Blow? They said all deep and funny, jokingly,
The Dolorous Blow, what was that?
But Merlin quickly shut them up. This was bad, very bad. All England was at stake, their lives were at stake, the well-being of the entire world was at stake. Balin and Pellam rolled their eyes. A typical Tuesday for an Arthurian knight. Every single time. World at stake, evil castle, the mysterious questing beast. Everything was just a joke to these guys. Merlin shook his head. Yeah, they were having a lot of fun being questing knights. Until now, this was serious. Please just take it seriously. Stop laughing. Balin and Pellam felt a bit of a chill run through them. Merlin had never been this serious before. They asked him the most important question. Could this power ever be undone? Merlin's voice was a rasping whisper as the crowds began to gather nearby out of curiosity. Only the Grail could do it. Balin fell later that evening in an unfortunate duel with his brother. Neither recognized each other until the brother had inflicted a mortal wound. Probably the magic of the spear, because how else does that happen? Pellam rebranded himself as the Fisher King because his kingdom was starving. Since the wound to his groin was so painful that he could not ride to the hunt, he took to the seas himself to bring the few remaining fish to his people so that they would not starve. But over time, the wound grew worse and worse, not better. As the years went by, the king could no longer even stand, and the pain became unbearable. His servants went all the way to the Middle East to find salves for the agony that the king experienced without ceasing. His people, grateful for his fishing days, carried him on stretchers to bathe in the holy lake, which eased his pain slightly. Meanwhile, a young man named Parzival is wandering from place to place, up to more or less no good. It's one of those extremely boring and overused tropes where the father died in war and the mother told him to never use a sword that brings artificial conflict in every story from medieval legends to, spoilers, one of the new popular movies out, because we know that they'll always get past that obstacle, and yes they do. Parzival decides he really wants adventures, so he decides to go on a quest and use a sword anyway. Conflict solved. Just spared you a lot of time. Parzival soon stumbles across a magical castle. Shadowy, wraith-like knights come out to slaughter him, but he draws his sword and kills them all. As he finishes off the last one, the Jewish man who Longinus had met after the crucifixion steps out and claps his hands, congratulating the young man on his victory. He explains that he had been cursed for centuries because he taunted Jesus. At first, he was inclined to believe in the man as the Son of God, but the passage of time made him bitter. In his first lifetime, he'd prayed and offered sacrifices, begging to be allowed to die. And he thought it was going to happen. He had grown older and older, and he had embraced the feebleness of old age. Any day, it was going to come. But by the time he reached the age of 130, he knew something was wrong. Still, humans had lived to that age, right? Maybe Jesus' curse hadn't really been to live forever, but to just live an unnaturally long life. Then one day, he had woken up and he felt something was different. His body wasn't stiff and racked with pain. It felt amazing. He thought he had died at first. But when he walked out into the street he saw the same city as he had seen the day before, but no one recognized him. It only took a brief glance into the mirror to learn the truth. He was a young man again. That was when he knew that he had truly been cursed, and that the power of the curse could not be undone. Still, in vain hope, he had gone to war, hoping to be slain by an enemy. He had rushed into the heat of battle, and thousands fell around him, yet he was never struck. He braved the icy cold and the burning heat, yet he never so much as fell ill. He wandered around, telling stories of a time that had long since passed into history, yet no one believed him. They drove him off, and his appearance became more and more twisted and uncanny with time. He began to hate the man who had cursed him, and he really hated his followers and all of the weird grail hunters and spear hunters and people who thought they could use the relics of Jesus' death to their advantage. He hadn't been that lucky. To him, Jesus' death hadn't been an opportunity for power, but a terrible curse. And to think that people were killing each other to profit off Jesus' death? He knew it was wrong to insult a dying man, but wasn't it worse to chase the things he had touched in life and fight bloody battles to the death in order to use their power for self-aggrandizement? And God seemed to actively encourage such brutality. After finishing the villain monologue, the Wanderer hurled the Spear of Destiny, which had fallen into his hands, at Parzival. After hundreds of years of practice, the Wanderer's aim was deadly. But Parzival's purity of heart allowed for him to access magical power. Don't ask me to explain that one, but that's what the story says. And as he held out his hand, the spear stopped in midair. The Wanderer gasped as Parzival began to make the sign of the cross, a magical incantation to break the Wanderer's power over the spear. As punishment for using the spear in battle, the Wanderer's castle was cursed, and the magic that held the place together crumbled. The Wanderer looked at himself for a few seconds, hoping that he, too, would finally die. But alas, he was still there. The spear's magic, twisted again, hid the Wanderer from Parzival's sight. Parzival, thinking the job was done, gripped the spear and headed back in the direction of King Pelham's kingdom. But the journey back was nowhere near as straightforward as the way there. The castle's magical implosion seemed to have done something odd to the surrounding landscape. Knaves came from far and wide to seek the source of the disturbance, and when they found an unknown knight holding the Spear of Destiny, they attempted to kill him and take possession of it. Knowing that he would bring a greater curse on himself if he attempted to use it, even to defend himself, Parzival used a combination of magic and his sword to defend the spear and make his way back to King Pelham. But the way became more and more confusing the more Parzival tried to return to the king. Dark magic clouded his way and left him baffled. Years passed. Long years. Parzival's way home was sudden. It was merely a typical day of wandering when he stumbled across a hut in the forest. It was one of the Grail Knights who informed Parzival that he had finally made his way out of the dark magic wilderness and into King Pelham's kingdom. Time was now of the essence. The king was in excruciating pain, begging for death, and the courtiers weren't exactly sure how long the king would last and whether the king might, in fact, take his own life. Parzival hurried toward the castle, clutching the spear, when he heard the king's cries of misery. His voice loudly commanded the knights to take his life and put him out of his misery, and some were willing to do it. But Parzival rushed up and held the spear aloft. What had once brought destruction when used as a weapon of war could bring life when used for peace. Parzival laid the spear against King Pelham's leg, and the wound began to miraculously close. The king sighed in the first relief that he had felt in the past 20 years. The king gave Parzival his heartfelt thanks. All was well. The spear did not heal the curse on the land, but merely the curse on the king. While the king's pain had ceased, the land was still decaying from the wounds of the dolorous blow. To heal the land, the Grail was required, and Parzival made that his life mission. He would be the one to heal the land. Parzival was knighted, and later joined Sir Galahad and Sir Bors in recovering the Holy Grail. Meanwhile, the spear made its way to the Middle East. Some claim that it was taken there when the Knights of the Round Table returned the Holy Grail to God on a mystical island. Others aren't sure how it got there. But Peter Bartholomew, a medieval peasant who had voluntarily joined the Crusades in hopes that doing so would absolve his sins, because nothing washes away your sins like killing infidels, and we Westerners blame one religion for extremism and act like this one was entirely normal. Anyway, Peter Bartholomew claimed that the spear had been returned to the Middle East sometime before 1098, when he dug a random spear out of the ground and held it up as the Holy Lance. Okay, this will totally help us in the Crusades, despite half the legends saying using the spear for violence is bad. One of Peter's companions had a question. Even though we are killing thousands of men, women, and children for really no reason besides that we can, and we want to own Jerusalem, which does us practically no political or economic good, and is a vast waste of resources when people are starving to death and dying of terrible diseases, there's a lot of reasons why this shouldn't work. Peter nodded. He had received visions from the apostles telling him, one, where to find the lance, and two, that the Crusades were absolutely a good idea. Anyway, think about it. It was either slaughtering women and children in war in the Middle East, or slaughtering women and children labeled as heretics back home. They'd be killing people regardless, may as well go into battle with a relic in the hopes of getting their sins forgiven. Peter's ideas are controversial by our modern sensibilities, and you'd be happy to know that they were also controversial in the Middle Ages. Not the killing people for religious reasons and forgiveness of sins part, that was pretty widely accepted as a good thing. What was very controversial was whether or not the spear was legitimate. For a while, people sided with Peter and he became the leader of the Crusades. I mean, the Middle Ages were a wild time where a good gimmick got you an unbelievably long way. But Peter didn't know where to stop and decided to push his luck. He started telling everyone that God had given him exact instructions for every battle, which didn't go well when the Crusaders lost. The kicker that really dropped him from leader status was when he started witch hunts, claiming that certain people were secretly evil and ordering that they be executed. His troops forced him to undergo the ancient alternative to a jury trial, which was trial by ordeal. If you have any questions about that, you can ask me, because I have actually done a graduate level paper on the trial by ordeal. The basic summary was that Peter had to walk across a set of red-hot iron plowshares and then bandage the burns on his feet. 3 days later, a priest would inspect his feet. If the wounds had begun to heal, Peter would be judged as being correct. These people were truly evil and did need to die. But if the wounds had not healed and instead were becoming infected, Peter would be judged as guilty and he would be the one to die. As a side note, fun fact, this method of fact-finding was pretty much the default in England until 1215. Well, Peter got burned so bad that he died outright. After that, most people were pretty sure that the spear that he had was not the Holy Lance. And it wasn't. The real spear reappeared when the man claiming to succeed, Genghis Khan, attempted to invade the Christian kingdom of Armenia. Armenia, the first state in the world to adopt Christianity as its official religion, feared that it would be swamped by the massive armies of the Khan's self-proclaimed successor, Tamerlane. Tamerlane's troops surged into Armenia, overwhelming the brave but outnumbered defenders. The Armenians retreated into a temple cut out of solid rock. An old, wizened man came out to meet Tamerlane. Tamerlane swung his sword, but it merely bounced off the man. The man told Tamerlane the truth. He had been wandering for centuries, and he would wander for centuries more. For years, he had fought it, but now he had accepted the truth. Jesus was Lord, and his life had been preserved as a witness. His life had been preserved to warn the world of the dangers of fighting against the power of God. The wanderer warned Tamerlane to flee. This temple held a spear of unparalleled power, and it was an artifact for peace. It could not be wielded by anyone in battle, but anyone who tried to approach the temple in war would be cursed. Tamerlane would be foolish to go into battle against it. Tamerlane, being a Muslim, and therefore not believing that Jesus Christ was the Son of God, and also not afraid of a magic spear after having killed so many people, brought his armies to the temple to give battle. But as he did, the sky began to darken, and in a perfect circle around the temple, rain and hail began to fall, lightning began to crash, and the ground began to shake. As Tamerlane foolishly led his troops into battle into the circle, hail began to strike and kill some soldiers, while massive lightning strikes slammed into the ground, killing whole groups. Yet Tamerlane persisted until he and some of his men were able to reach the shelter of the temple. There, the spear stood in a case in front of the altar. Tamerlane reached for it, but he felt an unknown power stopping him from moving. Many of his troops were struck by the same power and could not take another step. Others were struck blind as they gazed upon the spear. One managed to reach the spear, break through the case, and touch it, but he was hurled across the room and fell dead. Hundreds, maybe thousands, of men were disabled or killed by the power of the spear that day. When many had fallen, Tamerlane found the strength to move. To him, it was the only way to save his troops. As Tamerlane prayed to the spear and to God, his men became unfrozen. They fled the temple in terror. Tamerlane left many things behind in his camp as gifts to the people in the temple, in hopes that the curse might be broken. He fled the camp with his remaining men, and his armies never troubled Armenia again. No one really knows what happened to the spear after that. We know it didn't stay in Armenia because the Turks later perpetrated one of the worst genocides in history in that region. Nor do we know for sure what happened to the wanderer. Perhaps the wanderer took the spear to its final resting place or returned it to God, like the Knights of the Round Table returned the spear and the grail. More likely, though, the wanderer remains. There were rumors that he was spotted as late as the 1800s, traveling from place to place in a vain hope for rest. His only hope is in the soon coming of Jesus Christ to set him free from the curse. Perhaps if one could find him, he would know the whereabouts of the spear. But likely, the wanderer would not reveal the location, even if he knew it, as he has seen the heartache the spear brought in the days of old. Perhaps the spear is lost to us, or perhaps it is only missing for a time, and one day it will resurface to bring suffering again to our world. Or perhaps it will appear to do good, like how it protected the Armenians from having their country destroyed by the relentless Tamerlane. With this, we end the storytelling part of the episode. I'm going to start my analysis with what I like about this story. I really appreciate the Arthurian legend's interpretation that the spear is a curse when used in war, but a blessing when used for peace. The spear punishes those who attack it in battle, but also those who attempt to use it as a tool to gain victory on their behalf. Perhaps it's an allegory condemning those who use the sacrifice of Jesus as a tool to justify their violence and bloodshed. They use their Christianity to harm other people and drive them further from God. I doubt that was the original intent of the Arthurian Spear of Destiny legends, as people were getting burnt at the stake left and right, but maybe we can learn something from this interpretation nonetheless. What I like a whole lot less are the legends basically saying that anyone who gets the spear in their hands has God-given power. These legends basically credit Jesus' sacrifice with providing Adolf Hitler with the tools to create a genocide. Moreover, I object to the whole concept of the spear. Even if it is only a tool that blesses people who are at peace, the idea behind the spear is that God's power is more accessible when you have a magical object in your hands. The whole idea of relics is that holding an object in your hand brings you certain powers. It's an idea related to magic and mysticism. See the movie Doctor Strange, where the sorcerers pass out relics that grant the user magical powers, or a similar concept of artifacts in Ready Player One. The quote-unquote Christian belief of relics is the same idea. Having a piece of Jesus' body or a saint's body is supposed to grant you special blessings and abilities. That idea is the opposite of Christianity. Jesus did not sacrifice his body to be carved in pieces, fought over, and held in the hand of the highest bidder. He sacrificed his life so that you could have a better life, both on this earth and in the afterlife. He sacrificed his life so that you could escape the penalty of death for the bad things you've done and live a more fulfilling life free of those things. God's power is extended to everyone who believes, equally. There is no meritocracy or relic that you need to get your hands on. True religion focuses on what God does for you to convince you to love and help him. False religion focuses on what you do for God to convince him to help and love you. False religion grasps onto the relics, or the sacraments, or the things you do that make you feel good about yourself. True religion falls before God in gratefulness for his love and leads you to model your life after his. That's all for this week. Next time, we'll be doing a short story about one of the most famous women in the Bible. We'll be talking about Ruth, and we'll have a story with an uncomfortable amount of feet and some less than appetizing lunch menus. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. I love it when people listen to my podcast and learn something new. I love the subject matter that I talk about, and I can't wait to produce more content for y'all. One big thing you can do is tell your friends all about this podcast and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, especially Spotify. I need more reviews there, and I have amazing artwork there, so go check it out. Again, thank you so much for choosing to spend your time with me. Credits to myself, Caleb Howard, for theme music and script writing. Credits to the amazing artists of Open Source Music and Evoke Music for the accompanying music, and I'll see you next time.